Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein, Yeshiva Shalmaila. I think we may be the biggest shiur in the world. We're getting around, give or take, 15 to 25,000 listeners a week. So there's a good chance somebody in your shul is also listening, and maybe you can discuss it. Maybe you can get into an argument, a discussion. What's the very title? It's all about, Chadadim zeh zeh bahalacha, Talmid HaChamim, the Gemara says, sharpen each other by arguing with each other. I had somebody I met, I told him recently, I said, I never went to college. He said, an Italian fellow. He said, the best college in the world, he said, is going to yeshiva. They teach you how to think. This is from an Italian banker. So this week, we're going to have a very interesting discussion, genetic testing in halacha. How much information is too much information? We're sitting around the Shabbos table and asked somebody, would you like to know, going into a shidduch, any possibility, a reasonable possibility that your spouse could have a disease? A lot of people said yes. I said, well, how about would you like to know what type of living they would earn, what their temper would be like, we could tell genetically, what their life would be like, how many kids you would have, many of the other things that we could say would boil down to some type of a physical, a gene, or some type of a chemical, etc. What was their moods going to be like in the future? Then I said, well, what would you like? Would you like to know the day you would die? That's it. I have exactly till fill in the date. At how much point do we say, I'm sorry, this is just too much information? So we're going to be speaking about genetics and halacha. We will have Hagoyin Rav Herschel Shechter, Rav Shiva Yitzchak Elchanan. He's the OU's Paisik. We're going to speak about, today they have J-Screen. It tests for 220 diseases. He's going to say, you're going to hear Rav Herschel says, of course, if you could know and you could, through PGD, avoid the passing on generation to generation of diseases, what could be better? And then we're going to hear the Rav of Chicago, the Dayan Rav Shmuel first. He's going to permit Musbach by Ramosha. He's going to say, no, way too much information. Shidduchim won't happen if you know every other possibility. That's it. You talk about a Shidduch crisis now, that would cause a Shidduch crisis. And what about a little bit of a Munim and Betachin? We will speak from somebody, Nehemiah Kraus, a father of two children with muscular dystrophy, who will speak about how he wishes he did. But we will hear from two doctors who are leading ethicists on this, Dr. Daniel Eisenberg, professor of medicine at the Jefferson Medical School, lecturer of Refuah and Halacha, and Rabbi Gideon Weitzman from Eretz Yisrael, the director of PUA, Institute for Fertility. We will have a debate on this topic. I'm curious, what is your opinion? Now, of course, we get a lot of opinions. I put almost all of them up on our Mara Mekaymus page. We put our calls as well as our emails. I put almost all calls and emails as long as they are reasonably polite. Those that actually border into just rude, I don't have any time for rude in my life. Nor do I think that a forum where we talk about halacha and hashkafa has room for rude. And we get a lot of, just a lot of rude people. I remember, let me share with you a vart from a Beryl Soloveitchik on this week's Parsha. He said he heard it from somebody, a fabulous vart. He said, it says by the Arba, Moshe said, Pari said, take away from me, rak es hamaves hazais. Take this death away from me. So somebody came into a barrel and he asked him, why is it called Hamavis Hazais? A barrel said no. So the fellow told a barrel, he said, because Chazal say that the Arbed didn't eat on Shabbos. They were religious. They were a vicious enemy to Pari, but they were a frumer enemy. So this fellow said, Hamavis Hazais, there's nothing worse than a frumma maka is the worst maka you could have. With frumka we could do. So we get some really nasty calls. But everything, even the people who disagree the most, I put it on the air as long as it's done polite. I ask you to call in with your opinion. Before we go to our wonderful guests, I would like to share a vart. This week it's all about freedom. It's about Cheirus, Yitzias Mitzrayim. And what comes right after Yitzias Mitzrayim? Uksharetem la'ois al yadecha, the mitzvahs of tefillin, l'man tiyeh toiras Hashem beficha, tefillin right after Yetzias Mitzrayim. And the question is, why? Of all the mitzvahs in the Torah, why is tefillin coming right after Yetzias Mitzrayim? So I have a question for you, my wonderful co-listeners. What is freedom about? What is the mila hanerdefes that should go with cheirus? Is it cheirus from? Freedom from? Or Cheirus 2. Like, what does freedom from mean? Freedom from slavery, from oppression, from poverty, from molestation, from over demands, just fill in, from addiction. That's freedom from. We understand that. These are all the freedoms. Or is freedom about freedom to? Freedom to what? To be Ovid, whoever you would, to religious freedom, freedom to speak, freedom to make your own laws, freedom to legislate, freedom to control your day, your destiny, your future. What is freedom? So here's something interesting. I think that in the world we see very often how the concept of freedom has gotten destroyed. It's been lost. Freedom lost. The dangers of freedom. And let me share with you a story. I know somebody. He went to dental school, and he's a brilliant guy. So he figured out that there are many places that it's very difficult to take the patients, let's say, to a dental, you know, a dentist. So he bought some type of a truck. He put four different dental chairs in it, hired four dentists, gave them each, you know, whatever a good salary for a dentist is, and would start going to senior citizen centers, senior housing, nursing homes. He would line up, and people wouldn't have to go to a dentist. They would just bring out all 200 patients, and he became just filthy rich. And what did he do? He said, I don't have to work anymore. So he bought a huge screen. I don't know how big. He could afford anything, an 8-foot screen, and he sat at home, and he watched videos for 15 hours a day. It's a true story. He could afford it. He just had popcorn and videos 15 hours a day. I ask you, is this freedom? I mean, in our lives, we don't watch popcorn. But talk about freedom. You know what freedom? Freedom to, if it's just freedom from, but there's no freedom to, well, it could be freedom too many choices. Freedom to abuse. Freedom to divorce. Freedom to cheat on our spouse, freedom for alcohol, for drugs, for pornography, freedom from commitment. I mean, with technology, there's an endless amount of choices today, endless amount of choices, freedom to gamble all day. You don't even have to go to Vegas or Atlantic City. Today, the person could stay at home and online gamble endlessly. So freedom from is just a half answer. And you know, a half answer does nothing. Do you know that halacha? We spoke about Birchas Hagoyimel last week. I'll tell you something interesting halacha in Birchas Hagoyimel. Ramosha Paskins, and most of the Achrayim agree with him. He says, if you're going on a journey and it's halfway, you go to Eretz Yisrael, you do make a Birchas Hagoyimel on the flight. And he says, you don't make the Gaimel until you come back. It's a half a journey. You're not done. Freedom from is a half baked answer. Where is it to? Where is your freedom taking you to? Because otherwise you can end up, we see, Rahman al-Otsan, here's a statistic from the Washington Post. Your average 15, this is fresh, like current, the last, fifth. Your average 15 to 18-year-old spends 8 hours a day, not a typo, that was 8 hours a day on social media. So I'm talking about Unzer necessarily, but talk about how freedom from, without a freedom to, without a mission, without something to bind you to a laser-like vision, what do I do with all that freedom? The freedom becomes self-consuming. I mean, you see people, you know, they date, and they can never get married because there's just so many dates. There are so many shidduchim, so many women. Freedom becomes something destructive, too much freedom. So what does it say right after Yetzias Mitzrayim? The Torah is so weird, Klal Yisrael, that too much freedom. What do we say in Eli Tzion and Tisha B'Av? What do we say, right, about the Al Inui B'nei Chayrin, the torture of the free? Free people could also have torture. Klal Yisrael's Batsam Ben Chayrin. It's called Chayrus Eilam Yitzias Mitzrayim. But we are free people. Free people without a two ends up with all that abuse, divorce, cheating, alcohol, drugs, etc. So what does it say? The first thing after Yetzias Mitzrayim, l'taytafeis b'deinecha u'kshartem, tie it onto you, l'man tia toiras Hashem b'ficha. Create a mission. look at that mission directly in the eye and say, I'm going to use the gift of freedom that Baruch Hashem we have here in the world today, and I'm going to use that, Lamantia Tiras Hashem Beficha, because without it, too much freedom is just as dangerous as no freedom at all. Let's go to our wonderful guests for the hour debate. How much information is too much information? We have the great honor of having us on the phone, Hagoyin HaParashal Shechta. He's the Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan. He's also a noted speaker, Paisik, and he's the Halachic advisor for Kashrus for the OU. Welcome to the Rosh Yeshiva.
Thank you.
Let me ask the Rav. We had on the here on the radio, we had two different opinions. We had Dor Yisharim, which only tests for diseases that are caused when the husband and wife get married together. But for diseases that are in, and then there's a, and they test for, I don't know, 40 some odd diseases. And there's a new thing called J-Screen that tests for like 200 diseases, muscular dystrophy, et cetera. And they say that because of that, people who do it and find out that, you know, that they have a reasonable chance of, et cetera, of these diseases, they would suggest to them to use PGD or some other way to avoid, let's say, passing on muscular dystrophy, to have a child who has muscular dystrophy. Does Rosh Yeshiva have an opinion as to, now that they have these new tests, whether it is preferable to go with Dor Yisharim and say on these all these other diseases, Shem Ipsayim Hashem, or whether one should use J-Screen and with hope of maybe preventing a life of incredible hardship, both for the parents and for the child, and it doesn't fit into their Shem Ipsayim Hashem. What's Rosh Yeshiva's opinion?
I would say the second way. I don't think that Shem Ipsayim Hashem. That's like a blind person walking by the ocean. He's going to fall in and drown. Here, you can prevent it. You can test and you'll know in advance to take care of this. You use the PG, whatever it is there. PGD, Chvezos. So you see to it that you don't have these children who are the Bali moment. Why do you have to have aggravation for the rest of your life?
So would Rosh Yeshiva say that this Lamashal that the Mechaba says in Evan Ezer, and I think it's Simon Bays maybe, he says that a person shouldn't marry into a family that has of Nechaim. Yeah.
Sure.
Would so you see that there's no Shem Ipsayim Hashem, even though maybe this will be the healthy child. Would you say that using something like J-Screen would sort of fall under that general halakha?
I would think so. That's exactly what the Gemara tells you. You should be concerned about this. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and it's an honor to have you with us. Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan, Rabbi Herschel Shechta. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a tzlacha. A good year.
We have the honor of having with us from Chicago, Rav Hagoyin Rav Shmuel First. He's the Rav of Agudas Yisrael of Chicago. He is the Dayan of the Aguda, and he the famous Paisik from Chicago. Welcome, Rav First.
Yes.
So Rabbi First, we had on an individual who was talking about J-Screen, right, Rabbi? We had on Rabbi Jachter and Rabbi Leibowitz, and they were saying that there's a new program that tests the 200 disease, which is far more than what Dor Yisharim tests for. And subsequent to that, we had on a father who told a tragic story of he had two children with muscular dystrophy, that very likely today J-Screen would have screened for and through PGD could have avoided. Could the Rav share with us his opinion about these tests, such as Dor Yisharim, and now should we even do this greater test which J-Screen is advocating, which could eliminate many, many more diseases? What is your das Torah on this?
Anis Daiti, I think Dor Yisharim is a wonderful organization. They did great things. We haven't had, since Dor Yisharim is on the scene, we haven't had any cases of Tay-Sachs because of Dor Yisharim in the Frum community. And they deserve a big yashar koyach. I think now they've gone a little bit too far. They're doing tests that it's a miyut she'eino motzei very much, 1%, less than 1%. What happened with Talmud Ti Hashem Lekecha? And they want to start doing this J test. You're mentioning 200 things. I think it's getting out of proportion because you were not mechuyev to go so far. There's such a thing as Talmud Ti Hashem Lekecha, and something that's a mid she'enu motziv ma'od, even muted. It's not negeya. I don't think this test should be done, and I think it's wrong. And I don't know of any reputable Pesach that says you should go this far and do these 200 tests. I'm not even sure the tests that Darius Shoram started adding on after Moshe was nifted, they added on a bunch of other tests. I don't know who told them they should do that. I think they went a little bit too far, and they did a great job, and they should continue doing a great job, but I think they're doing too many tests. That really is a mitzvah and a matzah, and it's ruining shiduchim, it's ruining lives of people.
Well, they keep it confidential to the people. They don't tell it to anybody but the person involved. So when you say it's ruining...
Once they say it's not compatible, then you're telling them that that they have some type of gene, which is such a mitzvah and a matzah, which is nothing. I mean, everyone has genetic problems. There's not a family that doesn't have a genetic problem. What you can do over here at the end of the day is that who knows what's going to happen with Shidduchim down the road. I think they're going a little bit too far, maybe not a little bit, but a lot too far, and I don't think those tests should be done. I'm sure there are people out there disagree, but this Lanier's deity, I think that's the way they're going too far.
First, I mean, it's a very powerful point you're saying that people won't be able to make shidduchim anymore. Which is, would you be opposed a woman who has the BRCA gene? Are you opposed to girls testing for the BRCA gene? And as an addendum to that, if a girl has the BRCA gene, should she disclose it in a shidduch?
First of all, the BRCA gene, even if they have it, according to information that different types of BRCA genes. But according to information from the doctors I spoke to and what I saw printed, there's a book that's printed exclusively on this thing, it seems that you can have children, healthy children, and if you want to eliminate the bracket, you can do certain things done after your childbearing age. A woman could do certain type of surgeries. And I know a number of women who did those surgeries, and Baruch Hashem, cancer did not come to them because they did the surgery, and they had a high degree of the bracket number, and they eliminated by doing a certain surgery, and they were able to have all the children they want. And normally, it's done when a woman is already in the 40s already. That's usually what it's done. That's what I'm told. So therefore, I don't know if they should take this bracket test. I think it's still together, but Tom Ti Hashem Lekecha. Again, I'm sure that people out there disagree, but in this diet, I tell people not to do the bracket test.
But first, is it possible to say that the concept of Tomim Ti Hashem Lekecha, Al Tachger Achar Asidus, is something that's not known, whereas somebody being a carrier for a disease is known today? You could know that today, so it's not really a hakira.
She can have healthy children. You have the bracket, she can have a bunch of healthy children, and for her not to get cancer down the road, she does the certain surgeries that are necessary when she's in the 40s, after she's stopped having children.
Would she have to disclose it?
She could be a healthy, wonderful mother, wonderful wife, and she can have a healthy life, ad mei resim shana, even with having this bracket. And with knowing that she has it, all it's going to do is going to hurt her shidduchim down the road. So it's better not to know, and if there's a problem, down the road they'll take care of it.
Now, if a sibling has BRCA,
there's no proof that the other one. According to the information I have, there could be five girls, five sisters, two have it and three don't have it. Or it could be one has it and four don't have it, or it could be all five have it. There's no guarantees that every sibling will have it or won't have it.
So, Rabbi, first, if somebody has it, do they have a chiyuv to, despite their maybe interest in privacy, to disclose it to their sibling, so their sibling should be aware of their increased danger?
I would say they should tell the sibling when they get to a certain age. Why tell her when she's 15 years old? Let her,
right.
If the sister's a lot older, she has the problem, let her mention it to after she's married, and mention when she's, you know, in the 30s, you know, down the road, I think you should be check out if you have this bracket thing, and if yes, then get a medical opinion what you should do. Now, there are different, according to the information I have, there are different types of brackets. Certain ones are more aggressive than other ones. So she should be checked out by a good doctor.
Well, at first, it was a great honor to have you on with us. Thank you so much.
Also.
We have on the phone with us from New York City, Reb Nechemiah Krauss, who, rather than me telling his story and introducing him, let me introduce him and let him tell you our story. Welcome, Reb Nechemiah.
Hi, how are you?
Can you tell us a little bit about your story? Share with us.
Well, I got married, and I basically had two children. My first child was born approximately 3 to 3.5 years into my marriage. Since it was my first child, I didn't recognize necessarily signs that something was wrong, because you can't tell right away. He was developing slower, but again, because of our first child, we weren't as aware of it. If it was my second child, I would have realized right away, because I would have realized how a normal child develops. About when he was 10 months old, my mother sat me and my wife down. She said she thinks there's something wrong with our child. No overt signs, except he wasn't developing at the same rate. At that point, we actually got started going to doctors, and we got a diagnosis that he had autism, which was kind of wrong, kind of right, as you'll see when I continue. Because of that, because we live in such a Medina Shel Chesed, he got a tremendous amount of services. My Rebbe Movik actually has a child who's autistic, so he linked us up with something called ABA, and I became a little bit of an expert in myself, and we kind of basically really saw a miraculous development in that area. But because we had so many people in the house working with him, when he was about 2.5 years old, a physical therapist, is actually Chassidei Umas HaOlam, I'll tell you about that, he kept on pushing us that we should go back to the neurologist. He feels that something is wrong. Something else is wrong. Now, legally,
What is your child's name?
My older child's name is Yaakov Yosef.
Yaakov Yosef. After the...
No, actually, Yaakov is my grandfather and Yosef is the Mechaber.
Okay.
And so we finally actually mentioned to him one time, we made an appointment, and he actually had lived, we were living in Passaic at that time. He went ahead and said, when is your appointment? It was Monday, and he wasn't going to be back by my house till Wednesday. He said, I'm going to drive across New Jersey on Sunday. I want to give you something to give the doctor. What he was doing, actually, of course, we had no idea at the time, was he was literally writing a textbook, basically diagnosis without actually naming it, of the symptoms, so the doctor would know where to look right away. We didn't understand that until later on, looking back at that letter. Ignorance is bliss at that point. So when we went to the doctor, we gave him the letter. He was very relaxed. He said probably nothing, but he said, let's just do some tests. And basically, then we got the phone call later on that week, I need to see you in my office right away. And I was like, well, my wife's working. And so we worked it out. And it was actually a Thursday night or a Wednesday night. It was a Thursday night, and when we got there, he told us that basically my son's CPK, which is a sign of muscle breakdown, was 42,000. In an average person, let's say, I think it ranges from 150 to 300, if they've done a lot of exercise or something like that, and something is, so that gives you a little bit of a rate of muscle breakdown versus a normal person. And basically, he described in detail, I'm not sure why the pediatrician said a lot of people go into denial, so maybe that was his reason. He described in great detail what was going to be happening to my child. He actually told us basically by the age of 9 maximum, he's going to be in a wheelchair, and somewhere between 14 and 16, he's going to need to be on a breathing tube, and by 20, he'd basically be gone. And then he said, and you need to test your other children because your other son very possibly has it too. I already had my second son at that time, and so we didn't test him right away because we needed time to absorb the first one. And basically, we were living in Passaic, and an opportunity opened up for us to move back to Brooklyn.
What was your and your wife's reaction when he told you that your son has muscular dystrophy?
So I look at the hashgacha of the fact that we thought my son had autism first as, you know, a little bit of, so to speak, a kind of spoke of appearing us. Because we look back and dealing with the autism, which, again, we had dealt with it and we really got rid of, except for this, definitely always the lifelong effects. They call it more like an Asperger's, we turned it into. But, you know, so that was like a little bit of a softening up. We looked back and that was almost like a joke compared to what we ended up having to deal with. Our reaction was we were totally stunned. We don't really remember anything. We entered in like a daze for a few days. I happened to have about 6 months early become very, very close friends with someone who had lost 2 children to Tay-Sachs. So he rang our doorbell on Matzah Shabbos. So this is like Thursday night, so Matzah Shabbos. We don't remember much because we didn't really move much between Thursday night and Matzah Shabbos. And that's basically, it's interesting. Me and my wife both had the same experience. That's when like our memories start again. And he just rang a doorbell and he came and he sat down. And, you know, him and his wife were, so to speak, on the other end. And just that vision of someone on the other end somehow allowed the person to a certain extent to pull through it in a different way. You know, like Rav Henoch Leibowitz Zatzal says, he asks on the Gemara. The Gemara says that Hillel is Mechayev Daniyim, and it goes through a whole list of these individuals that Mechayev all these people. And he says, wait a second, if it's within the human capability, so why do I need a Hillel? If I'm obligated to learn even if I'm poor, then regardless of whether Hillel is there or not, if I'm not, because it's not within my capability, how does it help that Hillel existed? So somehow there's some kind of a dynamic within the human being that having an actual physical image, I don't, image is not the right word, reality of someone else who, so to speak, gone through and is pulled out, somehow allows the person to reach into themselves and pull out capabilities that they can't do without that.
And I'm curious, did you take Dor Yesharim tests before you got married?
Oh, yeah, of course.
But Dor Yesharim doesn't test for muscular dystrophy.
No, well, first of all, Dor Yesharim only tests for things that require two parents. Again, this might have changed, but Dor Yesharim, my understanding is their policy, they only test for things that require two parents as carriers to go ahead and it to occur. Muscular dystrophy doesn't work that way. Even in my wife's family, well, first of all, there's two things about muscular dystrophy. First of all, muscular dystrophy has the highest amount of what we call a germline mutation, which means that, which is not the case with my wife, which means that a lot of times the mother herself is actually not a carrier, and somehow somewhere between 20 to 60% of her eggs mutate when she's being created by the Vayeilum, and she could actually not be a carrier, and still the situation where the children will have muscular dystrophy. But otherwise, in my wife's case, actually, it's very interesting. My wife herself is a carrier, but her mother is not, and her father is not, which means my wife was being created. Her mother's eggs must have spontaneously mutated, and her mother's not a carrier, but my wife is a carrier. So you only need one person to go ahead and have this condition, so Dor Yesharim doesn't test that. That's number one. Number two, Dor Yesharim really tests for things that they've been able over time to bring down, so to speak, the cost. Like once we knew what we were looking for, we knew we were looking for muscular dystrophy, it actually costs $6,500 to find the particular mutation that we were dealing with. Now, my kids have a very, very unusual mutation in that the genes are broken down into exons and nucleotides. So most mutations are either what we call a duplication, which is an additional exon, or a deletion, which is a missing exon. And in my kid's case, one nucleotide in the body, and if you're aware, some genes have over 1 million nucleotides. One nucleotide, that's what I'm told. One nucleotide in the body is, so to speak, quote-unquote, the wrong nucleotide. And basically that causes the gene to be stopped reading the rest of the gene, so the body can't put out the expression. So to test for things like that would be, even if it were chronic appearance, would be prohibitively expensive. Like I said, once we knew what we were dealing with, because it was a nucleotide level, and by the way, they couldn't even do this till 2004, I think. I think that's what I've been told, to be able to look at the gene on a nucleotide level. So people that were much earlier, they would go ahead and test, and they would see that the kid had muscular dystrophy, but they would do genetic testing on the exon level, and they wouldn't even see, they couldn't figure out, like, what's going on, because the gene looked fine.
And then you found out about your second son.
Right, correct.
What's his name?
His name is Shimshon Yecheskel. We really basically knew, but we didn't want to know. We needed time to observe the first one, but once you have your first one and you were told it's a possibility, you start watching and you start seeing things, and you kind of, you know, but we didn't really know definitively, but basically when we're moving back to New York, we needed a definitive diagnosis for the services. But it was really, we really knew, because when we got back the results, we didn't even cry, because we had already, we basically knew.
Tell us what it's like living with two children who have muscular dystrophy.
So it depends really how you want to approach it. What me and my wife do is basically we do ad makim shadi magas. So we basically, from the moment they were diagnosed, we became like experts. And often, in fact, High Lifeline sends new parents to me sometimes to educate them. Sometimes I tell them, don't send them to me yet. They're not ready for all the information. So we really, we're very heavily involved in the care. So they have 45 minutes of stretching every day, because that's a side effect. They take all these medications, and each medication causes other side effects. So they have a severe osteoporosis. They have literally, I think I counted up about, it's 22 sessions of therapy weekly. That's addition to I take them swimming as much as possible to get them in the pool. Also, we have the mainstream, which is itself a challenge, because there are some cognitive effects. It's like a little bit of they don't fit anywhere. They need a massive amount of support to be able to manage in the mainstream. Like during the summer, I actually spend 2-3 hours teaching them every day to try to help them get through the first few months of the next year. So basically, that's essentially what life is, therapy and medicines, and they have a lot of simcha. You know, we always try to keep things very happy, and they're very known for that. They're being extremely happy. So that's
really. Are you able to work given all this?
me and my wife actually both work part time. We actually have an unusual situation, which works for us and prevents a lot of. And we're both very heavily involved in all the aspects, and a lot of situations like this. One of the members of the couple ends up being totally involved in trying to manage just the financial aspects, and the other one is totally involved in the physical aspects of the care, and it becomes they can't necessarily relate over time, and each one has very, very different stresses. So in a sense, it actually works well, because we're both in both worlds that way. And I really officially, the way I set up my life is I'm supposed to be learning half the day. And it depends whether I have to deal with stuff, which is very often. You're really, between all the services and all the things, you're really managing $500,000 budget of services, and it takes a lot of effort and everything involved. And you always have these things thrown at you. This week, for example, right before we got on the phone, I was dealing with the medicine I used to buy from them from England for the last 10 years for $600 a year. They approved in the United States. So now that it's legal in the United States, you can't buy it from England. And instead of $600 a year, it's $80,000 a year. So we were dealing with that. Baruch Hashem, we got it approved this week. So that's taken care of. But there's always things. My wife, at night, the amount of time she spends on the phone just dealing with managing the basic aspects of everything is unbelievable. Para gets sick, or she can't go to school that day because it's not safe because of his osteoporosis. So you have constant things thrown at you. And then, of course, you know, one of the interesting things you find out is all the regular things that happen to people still happen to you. So on top of that, you know, you still have a situation where you have a water table problem in your basement, and if it rains too much, your basement floods, and you still have someone banging into your car, and all those other things that still happen, which take people's time, you have to find the time to deal with besides for this. It's not like something, you're a little surprised in a sense at the beginning, like, hey, I'm dealing with this big thing, so everything else should work out, but it doesn't actually work that way.
So let me ask you a question. Do you have any other children?
Yes, I have. Thanks to Boney Olam, I have a daughter. She's 5 years old.
And when you say thanks to Boney Olam, they did PGD. Is that it?
Yes. They actually, the story. What happened was my sister had got married, and her husband lost his mother during Shana Rishona. And what they did, unbeknownst to us, is they sent out a letter, not mentioning her name, discussing her situation and asking people in Zecher Nishmas, his mother, to go ahead and donate money. And then when they had $20,000, they came to us and they said, here's $20,000, why don't you see what you can do? My daughter is actually named after his mother. So we had approached Boney Olam at that point, but that first $20,000 really only just started the process. I think, I'm not sure exactly, by the time we finished, they probably spent an additional $130,000.
Well, then PGD chose eggs, basically, that are not that will not carry forward.
Well, it's not as simple as my father put it out. He said, oh, he thought once we contacted Boney Olam, and there's science out there, it's a done deal. It still requires, as everything in life, a tremendous amount of miracles in Yad Vashemaya. because right, what PGD does is it takes off a cell on day 3 out of 6 cells. So you have to, you first have a just a normal process of IVF, and you know, itself, it's not automatic. And then when you're taking one cell off on, I think it's day 3, basically you could collapse a lot of eggs. Again, the more science develops, the less the risk becomes, because they get even high, more higher specialized lasers. But just think of yourself, someone could cut off 1/6 of your body, even if they would try to do it in the most optimal way possible. Think of what your chances of survival are, so to speak.
So let me ask you, Mohamed, do many people have children with muscular dystrophy?
The official numbers are, I think, one out of every 3,500 births. I don't know what in the firm community. There's definitely, I mean, I guess the circles we run in, we know a lot of them. So, you know, that could also skew your view of reality. But there's definitely a very decent amount. And for some reason, when we were, it's actually, to me, could be anecdotal. Seems like it's increasing tremendously, because when my kids were diagnosed, I think we were like, seemed like, from what we understood, we were the first family in a few years, and just in the last few years, just constantly. I mean, my son kind of was, so to speak, one of my sons in his school, he was the first boy with this condition there in their history, and now they have another, I think at least 2, maybe even 3 boys with that there that are mainstreamed over there. And,
sounds like a very special school.
Yeah, but they're mainstream in different schools, but both of them work with my boys.
How do other parents that you've experienced deal with it? Like, how do they deal with the trauma? Are they able to deal with it?
It depends. It's not easy for a lot of people. The way I look at it is most pain in life is called caused by what I call karech hamaduma, which means imagination. So I remember actually the first time I was exposed to this concept was actually my friend who had lost a child in Tay-Sachs. He told me something which I couldn't understand at that point, but I thought about it a lot because I knew he wasn't crazy. And he said to me, if he was raised from the time he was born, that he's going to grow up, he's going to get married, have children, that he's going to take care of them as they die, as he put it, then it would have been a lot easier for him to deal with his situation. It was a shocking comment to me. I didn't understand it until I realized over time what he was really saying is that the hardest part of how a person is going to deal with what happens to them is whether they're going to accept their reality and deal with it as their reality, or they're going to live in their imagination still. When a person lives in their imagination, it's very hard for them to move on. So, and it's, of course, a very big challenge because your whole world is completely different than you've ever imagined. So that's really, I find that has a tremendous effect in whether people deal with it one way or the other, is really, you know, that step about whether they still live in the imaginary world that, you know, that most people get to live in a sense, to a certain extent, or they live in the reality. And that's one aspect. And the other aspect, of course, just, you know, literally getting through the day-to-day life.
Can you tell us about some people who maybe haven't handled it so well that you know of?
Yeah, well, according to High Lifeline, the divorce rate is astronomical, which is understandable.
How high is it?
I don't know if the numbers are real, but I don't know if it's a scientific number, but I was told at least 50%. And that's, I think, in the firm world. In the Gentile world, it's much higher than that.
And why is that?
Well, because, first of all, you think of it this way. There's a lot of reasons, but I'll start off very simple. If you ask anybody who does any marriage counseling or anything, et cetera, they'll always say, oh, you have to take care of yourself first, right? But what if literally every time you even want to take care of yourself a little bit, you're doing it at the expense of your child? So then what? Right? So what if there is no such thing as a Sunday because you're literally running around from therapist to therapist? Or for example, actually the only time me and my wife get to go away is basically essentially when my kids are at Camp Simcha Special, and we really need a break because otherwise it's just too complicated to deal with everything that's involved in their care. Nobody could do it.
Do you know people who were broken by it?
Oh, of course. 100%. I mean, most people are, I think.
Defined, like, what does it mean they're broken by it? What does that mean?
They look at their life as not really the life they wanted, and they look at their life as a life of suffering and rather than living. I would define, I don't know if that's a good example, but I would find someone who's broken defines that they're not living life, but they're basically, so to speak, I had an aunt, a great aunt, Halava Shalom, she used to say at the end of life, I'm pushing the days, which means they're just, so to speak, counting the days and doing what they have to do to get through, so to speak, until the end. I would call that someone who's broken. I don't know if that's a good definition, but off the top of my head.
Now, if there are tests out there that can prevent a lot of these diseases, or if there were a test out there that could, you know, before when people get married, they would say, look, you know, you have to do PGD from the beginning because you could have a child with muscular dystrophy, would you encourage parents to take it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are two shittas in halacha, so as far as I understand, but in the literature community, it's definitely the halachically viable option. There's nothing to talk about. I think, excuse the expression, but you have to be literally neat and want to be in a mental asylum if you had opportunity and you didn't take it. If you were aware and I mean, again, like I said, I wouldn't consider myself a broken person. It's the reality. But if someone was provided with the opportunity and it existed and they were aware, so to speak, that it was an issue and they didn't take it, I don't even think that's a realistic thing. I think someone would be insane. I don't think any sane person would actually choose that. The only way someone who is sane would actually consider that a question is if they actually didn't understand the reality. That's the way I would put it.
What would you say to the small cadre of Rabbanim who discourage testing before marriage?
What would I say to them? It's not my place to say anything to them. Again, it's a tricky business because the question is where Tam Tiyah Mashalikach ends and where Hishtalis begins. If they're Rabbanim who have, so to speak, tremendous standing and they're accepted people who have clear Masorah, then if that's Torah. So it's not really a place to say anything to them, but it's definitely it has to be someone who, you know, when someone's addressing a shayla, usually they have to be a weir, so to speak, of the actual reality of what they're dealing with. For example, when I first started with IVF and PGD, I don't have permission to mention his name. I was relatively close to a tremendous Adam Gadol, and I really wanted him to paskin the shaylas for me, and he really was very. Which was really responsible of him and responsible of me. He really was really pushy that he really wanted me to go to someone else. And I was really pushy that I wanted him to because he ended up doing it. But over time, I realized that, and he had no problem, he was really correct because he lacked the expertise in this particular area and the knowledge of it. And, of course, that could also affect, halacha many times if you actually understand the reality differently. For example, I know with Kopavad, right? One of the questions was affected different psukim by different poskim was, do you see something and you can't tell it's a bug until you put it in the microscope, or you could even see it's a bug if you're trained beforehand, right? So often the mitzias could definitely affect the halachic outcome just because you need to have the proper mitzias.
Well, thank you very much for talking and sharing the experience, and I hope that I hope that the message reverberates with our listeners. Thank you very much. Nechemya, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Zagazan.
Kultiv. We have on the phone with us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Dr. Daniel Eisenberg, who speaks and lectures around the country on various issues of halacha and refuah. He's a practicing radiologist. He's a professor at Jefferson Medical College in the greater Pennsylvania area. He's a graduate of Machon Shlomo. Welcome, Dr. Eisenberg.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, Dr. Eisenberg, we've had 2 weeks ago, we had on the radio Rabbi Leibowitz, and he was speaking to somebody from J-Screen, and they were telling us that they do 200 tests
some large number, I don't know the amount, far more than Dari Sharm, and they're able to screen for many issues like, you know, certain muscular dystrophies and many, many other diseases. And then we had on somebody who's the father of two children with muscular dystrophy and who was telling us, you know, the what a living, you know, he said, if you can screen for this and you don't, he said, you're insane. He said that's what he would advise parents based upon the life that he leads. And I was, as somebody who's an expert in medical ethics, can you give us your opinion on this?
Yeah, I think that the question about Dari Sharm versus traditional medical screening is a question that comes up a lot. And I think it's very important, particularly for your audience, to understand that the medical clinical approach and the Dari Sharm approach are very different. And what I mean by that is, from a medical point of view, we are interested in identifying all diseases and therefore decreasing suffering, treating disease as an objective standard. Dari Sharm's approach is to prevent shidduchim that will result in unacceptable or untreatable suffering. That is, Dari Sharm is not really in the genetics business. And I don't mean that in any derogatory way. I mean that in a positive way. Dari Sharm exists so that there will not be shidduchim that could cause preventable suffering. That doesn't mean, therefore, that Dari Sharm wants to identify every possible abnormality. That is, I have a son right now going through shidduchim, and the issue is there are always unexpected things. There are always things you'll never know. The question really is, what would you really like to know? And so, therefore, Dari Sharm has to make a very specific choice as to which things to screen for, because they give a binary answer. I'm presuming that your audience understands how Dari Sharm works. And therefore, when the numbers from Dari Sharm are called in, the answer you will get is either acceptable or unacceptable. Given that you're not going to find out what you are a carrier for, Dari Sharm has to take it upon themselves with rabbinic guidance to decide what would be significant enough that we will presume that a third party would not want to date someone if there was a possibility that they could have a child with so-and-so disease. Now, J-Screen
What is percentage is considered significant? Like, let's say it was 10%, 20%, 2%. Like, do you have an idea of the parameters?
Obviously, number one, significance in the eye of the beholder. But, for instance, on medical panels, one of the ballpark numbers they use is that something in the population that has an incidence of 1 in 100 or greater is considered to be something significant enough to screen for. But the way the screening works now, it really is not more expensive to screen for 200 diseases than 20 diseases. So therefore, from a medical perspective, if I can identify a gene, I might as well test for it. That doesn't mean that that gene is of hashkafic, I guess, importance. Let's say there were to be a trait that both partners were carrying, right? But that would cause a disease that was treatable. Would that be a reason to call off a shidduch? So that's not a medical question. That is a rabbinical question.
So do you know how? Let's say it's a 1% chance. What would the binary answer of Dari Sharm be in that case?
Well, in advance, they don't work like that. Once Dari Sharm has chosen what they're going to screen for, and if you go to their website, that'll give you a list of exactly what they're screening for, right? So once they have chosen a disease as something to screen for, if both partners are positive, they will say it's not a good shidduch.
Even if it's less than 1%?
If they've chosen that disease, they're not telling.
Do you know what their parameters are? Like, at what percentage do they say, look, we cut off here because it's not significant enough for us?
I think that the answer, and I'm not really evasive, the answer is it's not just a number. It's a number combined with how severe. For instance, everyone has heard of Tay-Sachs. And luckily, in this population now, in the United States, if a child is born with Tay-Sachs, it's more likely to be non-Jewish, which is very interesting. But Tay-Sachs is such a catastrophe. That was the topic of Moshe Feinstein's tshuva in the early 1970s about screening, where he said you could say tamim tiyeh mashev lokecha, like we say in this week's parsha, right? But he said it's like closing your eyes to a terrible matzav that's in front of you. Now, not everyone would take the same, and that's a 1 in 30 or so, 1 in 25, 1 in 30 probability. There are some diseases that are really, really serious that are less than 1 in 100. There are some that are more serious and are less frequent. So the answer would be, I think, a rabbinic one, which would be how much do, at what point do I say Shomer Pesach Hashem? And you don't say that for things that I guess are easily preventable. But we all get in the car and drive, and we all do activities of daily living that have a certain amount of danger. And so that's, I think, what kind of goes into the whole thoughts. I mean, I'd like to point out a few things. For instance, 1 in 2 Jews is a carrier for at least one of the diseases on the standard J-screen panel. That means half of the people who get screened are positive for something. But it could be unbelievably unlikely, rare, and therefore it's very, very, very unlikely that any partner is going to also be positive and they're not going to have a problem. 1 in 100 couples screened are both carriers for the same condition. So if you go, for instance, to screening at any reputable lab or through J-Screen, 1 in 100 couples are going to be positive for the same condition. And the last very interesting thing is, it's estimated that every person is a carrier for a gene for at least 5 serious recessively inherited diseases. We just don't know what the genes are yet. Eventually, everybody will wind up being positive for something. And so that's, I'm just dealing with the stigma question from Duryea Shuren. Anyway.
So, could you give us, like, when you speak about this topic, well, yeah. We obviously have to have somebody from Duryea Shuren on to tell us, like,
right.
What do they consider significant,
right.
et cetera.
Right.
What's your opinion? Do you believe in what J-Screen does? Because the counter argument to that would be is that if 1 in every 2 people is going to have some disease that's carried on J-Screen, that maybe could be 1 in 1,000. In effect, people wouldn't get married anymore. I mean, it becomes a level of absurdity, right?
Right. 100%. So it's very, very important to understand, I think, 3 things. Something called genotype versus phenotype, which means, genotype means what genes you have. Phenotype means do they express. So number one, carriers express basically no abnormality. The fact that you are positive for a gene for a recessively inherited disease does not make you sick in any way. When you go into screen, you're healthy. When you walk out, you're still healthy. It just gives you information. It would be absurd if people were to not marry based on something which is, I don't know, let me put it a different way. I'm not sure. When you find out that you are a carrier for something, regardless of how unlikely it is, right? You still, if somebody else is a carrier for the same thing, would not want to marry. It's just that the probability of that happening is unbelievably small. So if there was a probability of 1 in 100 and, let's say 1 in 100 carrier rate, that means the probability of 2 people who didn't screen randomly matching up is 1 in 10,000. So then the question comes up, do I need to screen for that? But if I could screen for that, and I knew that I was a carrier for this rare gene, and that the person that I am being set up with is a carrier for that gene, I probably would not want to date them if it was a really serious disease. So the screening should not be preventing people from getting married.
Even if it's 1 in 100.
Yeah, because it's 100% once you have it. That is to say,
I understand that, right. but there's, you know, if you say 1 in 2 people is going to be a carrier for a rare disease. You know, we just
for a disease on the panel.
I understand. So yeah. As it is, shidduchim is so fraught with. We have a shidduch crisis now.
No, I understand.
If we want to layer on the shidduch crisis, say, you know, now if there's a 1 in 100 chance we're not going to go out with that person, etc.
But it doesn't work with it. That I think that's a misunderstanding of the way the screening works, because it's not an issue of chance anymore. If you go in and you get screened and find out you are a carrier for an exceedingly rare disease. You have the gene for the disease. You're healthy, right? All that tells you is, at the moment, that the probability that you'll meet somebody else with the same gene is unbelievably unlikely. So that means, assuming the girl also is screened, the probability that someone's going to set you up with something like that is 1 in 10,000, 20,000, 30,000. But if you were to be set up with someone, would you really want to marry someone when you know 100% that you're both carriers? That is, you're not choosing to not get married because of the probability that someone has something. The whole point of screening is you know, and you've excluded the possibility. So the point would be, if I put something on that panel that has a 1 in 1,000 chance, which would be unnecessary because the probability is so low, but I did it. And for some strange reason, you wound up positive for this gene. And then someone went to set you with a girl who also screened as positive for this gene. There's now a 1 in 4 chance if you get married that each child will have the disease. But
wait,
the probability that will happen is...
But the probability to happen is what?
What do you mean? That is...
I'm saying if somebody who's 1 in 1,000... it's a 1 in 1,000 that their child will have that disease.
No. That's not the way it works. It's 1 in 1,000. When you walk in, I suggest to you, let's say you
go in. The carrier, you mean?
Right. I go
one in 1,000 is a carrier.
The
now, let's say two people who are carriers of this disease get married. At what point, what are the odds that they have a child with it?
If
disease?
Two people with the same gene, 1 in 4.
Yeah.
1 in 4.
Oh, my God. So that's already very significant.
Right, but I'm saying, that's what it is with these three things. It's very important. So genotype versus phenotype, gene versus disease, right? We all have a certain number of chromosomes. They are doubled. We have 46 chromosomes, and you need 2 of each gene for each trait, right? Some traits, if you have 1 gene for it, will express, and that's called a dominant disease. Some things you need 2 genes for. All right, in a kind of in a strange sense, I could say to you that brown eyes is a dominant condition and blue eyes is a recessive condition. And the probability of 2 people who marry who are carriers for blue eyes, meaning 2 people with brown eyes but have a gene for blue eyes, 1 in 4 chance they'll have a child with blue eyes. But we don't object to blue eyes. This 1 in 4 has nothing to do with the carrier rate. It has to do with the idea that if 2 people with the same trait, right, were to have children, each child has a 1 in 4 chance of having that trait. If that trait is Tay-Sachs, you want to avoid that at all costs. If that trait is blue eyes, you may be happy to have that trait. So the idea of testing for things that are very unlikely should have no impact on the Chinook crisis. Because,
so Dr. Eisenberg, are there diseases that if 2 people are both carriers, the odds of them having a child, notwithstanding the fact that they're both carriers, with that these are still very remote. Are there diseases like that as well?
I'm not sure. I can repeat the question. I'm not sure I understand.
Let's say you have
disease
X, that 1 in 1,000 people, 1 in 5,000 have it, marries somebody else by unfortunate coincidence.
Right. They're a carrier.
Also is a carrier.
Right.
Are there diseases that, notwithstanding the above, the chances of them having a child are still only 1 in 100?
No.
Because if two people are both carriers, the chances go up more than incrementally. They grow up dramatically. And should they be unlucky and both have this disease, at that point,
this disease. It's very important. If they are unlikely and both are carriers for the gene, they're both
the chances of their children then having it are 1 in 4.
Assuming it is recessively inherited.
So then what's the argument not to use J-Screen? Like I heard Rabbi First say, well, Tamim Tiem Hashem Alekecha, you know, it's just such a remote thing. Well, it's not remote if they're both carriers.
Okay, so
and it's not Tamim anymore because you could check for it now.
It's an excellent question. And that's why I started out saying that medical clinical approach is identify all disease. And reassurance approach is to prevent shidduchim that would be problematic. So at this point, they have to ask the question and say, how likely does something have to be for me to worry about it? But it's not me. It's reassurance. That is, reassurance has to decide what is it worth testing for, and I'll tell you why. Let's say, and this is, again, a absurd analogy, but let's take blue eyes as the trait, right? Blue eyes is a recessive trait. Now, the question is, what would happen if Duryodhana decided that they're going to put blue eyes on the panel and 2 people come up positive for blue eyes and they only give binary answers and say, yes, it's a match or no, it's not a match? Well, if the answer is that we don't care about blue eyes, right, then you're going to say it's a match. Why bother testing for it? Duryodhana is only going to test for those things, I presume, that their rabbinic advisors are telling them are significant enough that we're both to be positive. They will say no. Now, you're asking a good question. I don't know. It is worth asking Duryodhana the question about whether there's an incremental cost. And that may be the answer, and that may be reasonable. For instance, I could build a car that would significantly decrease risk of death in driving. And I'll call it a Sherman tank. but it'll cost you $500,000. It'll drive 5 miles an hour, and it'll use 1 gallon of gas per mile. So the answer is no one will buy it. So it's always a trade-off between how much do I spend, how much do I give up, how much time do I spend to save the probability of saving this many lives. And every life is valuable, but there still is the question of there's no limit to how many things I could test for. So the medical approach is to say there's no ethical issue. Test for everything. You should know. Know what you have, and then knowledge is power, right? But that's not what DuraSurance set up for. And the other thing is DuraSurance audience, their target audience are people, I think, who don't really understand necessarily the intricacies of genetics, which is perfectly fine. DuraSurance is set up for people who just want to know the answer to whether or not it's okay for my son to date this girl, right? I think it's a very interesting distinction. Rabbi Bleich and Ramosha had a disagreement as to how to screen. Ramosha's tshuva is what led to DuraSurance, is my understanding. Ramosha and his tshuva, after the Tay-Sachs screening test came out, said, screen Batsina, don't do it in shivas, in seminaries. Don't tell people, you know, because teenagers have nerving, he says. They make a big deal out of small things, and there's a big stigma. And interestingly enough, he said that even though the doctors tell you that if two carriers marry, there's no chance of having a child, people don't believe it. But that's a little bit of an issue of ignorance. Obviously not a promotion point. He is saying, what can I do? The reality is there's a stigma attached to marrying a carrier. But there shouldn't be, and it's not even clear today that there still is. Rabbi Bleich, in an article, writes and says, a downside to this approach, the DuraSurance approach, is it turns it into what seems like a Byzantine hocus-pocus process. That is, if I tell you that there's information about you, and I'm going to test you for it, but I won't tell you what it is, that seems to imply that it must be something that's really bad. Because if it wasn't bad, why wouldn't I tell you? So the real question has to come up today, is there really a stigma attached? The only possible downside would be to say, if I marry a carrier, there's a possibility my children will be carriers, but carriers are healthy. And Ramosha thought that that's not a, being a carrier is not a significant problem. It's not a pagum. And therefore, right, best to just let people know that it's okay to marry. But it's really important to understand the test, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. Recessively inherited diseases. If two people are carriers, there's a 1 in 4 chance of having a child who's affected. Doesn't matter what the disease is. It just matters whether we care enough to make sure that that doesn't happen. And Tay-Sachs was fantastic. It was basically eliminated from the Jewish population due to screening.
So Rabbi Bleich believes we should tell everybody what the issue is.
He goes further. He thinks children should be screened at birth. He thinks there should be mass screening when children are born. In this country, there are multiple diseases like this that every single child is screened for in the hospital at birth. Right? This is called fetal ketonuria. Fetal ketonuria is a recessively inherited disease. Every child in this country is tested for it at birth. And the reason they test is very simple. Because if you know that the child has it, you can modify their diet, and it's treatable, and the life is fine. If you don't know they have it, and you don't modify their diet, they become very sick. So therefore, it's valuable to know whether or not they have it or not. Right? There are other diseases, for instance, which are you can't do anything about. Right? And therefore, the state does not test for them. And I think there's 30 different, at this point, 30 different of these diseases that children are screened for in the hospital. I don't know how many people realize that. And the reason is
so
because they're treatable.
So you're an advocate of J-Screen, is that it?
The truth, I am an advocate for screening. For instance, my children have gone through DuraSurance. Right? That does not mean that they're going to do the exclusion necessarily, everything else. But the world in which I travel, my son was in Philly Shiva for eight years, right? There's a social context to the screening. The social context is a community in which people are going to go on strict shidduchim, meaning no one's going out with somebody that they just met somewhere. They are only going out once both families have agreed. DuraSurance is a spectacular and successful way to do this, with the understanding that it doesn't test for so many things, but it tests for some really big ones, and it makes a significant dent in the number of sick children that are born, right? So that's
Bechtel, Dr. Eisenberg, I want to know if you'd be willing to come on to the phone if we can get Darius Sharam to, like, do a three-way with you and Darius Sharam. Would that
sure.
be okay?
Sure.
So let's reconvene. I want to thank you very much. Thank you so much, Dr.
Eisenberg.
Oh,
you're
Eisenberg.
Welcome.
Okay?
Thank you very much. Yep.
Hold
it.
Then take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
We have on the phone with us from Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Gideon Weitzman, who's the Rav of Pua. Welcome, Rabbi Weitzman.
Thank you very, very much.
Rabbi Weitzman, for our maybe less than knowledgeable American crowd who doesn't know much about Pua, can you tell us a little bit about Pua, what it does, how many people it employs, how many calls or whatever services it does a year? Give us a summary.
Okay, of course. I'm very happy to. Thank you very much for having me on. The Pua Institute was established over 20 years ago in Israel. We started with very small and humble beginnings and now have branches all over the world, including in North America. We have an office in New York. We have an office in Los Angeles, in Europe, in South Africa, Australia. And the Pua today does really three things. We have 12 or now almost 15 rabbinim who answer questions. I'm one of them. All questions related to fertility, gynecology, intimacy, women's health, contraception, birth, after birth, Tarat HaMishpacha. We're not doctors, but explain the procedures, give halachic advice, obviously give psak, and give referrals where people should go to, what treatment they should undergo. We also supervise fertility treatments all over the world, including in North America, throughout North America, South America, Canada, and throughout Europe, Israel, as we said before, Australia, South Africa, to ensure that there's no mistake made in the lab. We've prevented dozens of such mistakes that otherwise would have happened were it not for a halachic supervision of Pua. And the third thing we do is educate. We educate doctors, rabbis, the public, men, women, in order to be more knowledgeable and more aware of the issues of, as we said, of fertility, intimacy, genetics, adolescence, and Tarat HaMishpacha. That's really what we do in a nutshell. We have about 100 supervisors worldwide. As we said, we have 15 rabbanim and small office staff in America and in Israel.
So, for example, here in America, we have an organization that works on fertility, is actually two. What would you do that's different than them?
Well, you have Bone Olam. Bone Olam started off giving money, and that's really their spec, and they also give advice around their giving money, which is a complementary to what Pua does. They service a slightly different community, and there are certain things that because they are giving funds, so they will decide that their funds are best spent in one place and not in another place. A-Time is a support group, is an organization set up by people who went through fertility, who support other people and to be a support and to be able to assist them. But they don't do, we are more of a professional organization, not someone who's been through it necessarily. We have a wider network, we're international, and there are a lot of things that the three organizations do that are similar. But as I said, I think we service a slightly different clientele, and I think we have a wider net of things that we deal with.
Well, so what's your position on genetic screening? First of all, do you believe it's halachically required? What is Pua's position? And then let me make it a little more complicated. There are in America two different ways to do it. There is there's the famous screening that everybody goes through, Shidduchim. You know, I did it myself.
Sorry.
And that which tests for, basically a small number of diseases. I think it's more, but they used to be, but it's, I don't know, 20, 30, 40. And then there's J-Screen, which runs a panel of hundreds of tests. What is Pua's position about, A, should we get screened, and B, which screening is better, the Darisharim or J-Screen?
Just to clarify, because for me and for your listeners, you're talking about premarital genetic screening.
Correct.
Which means not that we're talking about a woman who's pregnant and we're going now prenatally to test.
No.
Let's see what's
the
state of
premarital.
But we're talking about a couple that are coming to get married who would want to know, is this a good marriage or not? But let me give a little bit of, I'll give a little bit of history, and then I'll tell you my position, our position in Pua. So a little bit of history is that the first people to start off doing any genetic screening, not only in the Jewish world, but pretty much in the world at all, was Dor Yesharim. And no one had ever done any genetic screening before, and it came to it because the famous story that Rabbi Eckstein, the founder, he had himself was a carrier of Tay-Sachs, his wife was a carrier of Tay-Sachs, and they had children who died of Tay-Sachs. And therefore he said, this is ridiculous, we know about Tay-Sachs, there's no reason it should happen. And all the Rabbanim came out against him, pretty much, because they said, once you test everybody, we're going to get more and more Mishpachat HaNichsim, as the mission tells us, a person shouldn't marry a woman from Mishpachat HaNichsim, we won't have a tainted family, and so you're going to create more and more tainted family. But he came up with a brilliant and a unique idea, and when I speak to my non-Jewish colleagues, which they are amazed about it, that we have a serial number. You don't get an answer, you get a serial number, which means you get a number on a computer, and when the young bacher and the young girl come to think about getting married, not when they get married, but when they think about getting married, they check the numbers, and if they both have the same recessive genetic abnormality, they say to them, that's a problem, you can't get married. And if they don't, they say, go ahead. So that's what they did, and it's an amazing, unique, and phenomenal organization that has basically, in one generation, eradicated Tay-Sachs. And as you said correctly, over the years, they added more things to their panel. I think they have 15 as their regular panel. You can have some more if you know. And that's a wonderful, wonderful way to treat a very specific problem, which is known, recessive, common genetic abnormalities. There are, in the community, things that are not recessive, that are not, it depends who you marry. For example, BRCA gene, the BRCA gene is a very common gene in our community. It causes certain types of female cancers, mostly ovarian and breast cancer. It is a very, it's common. If you think in North America, 0.3% of the women have BRCA. In the Jewish community, 2.5% of women have BRCA. So it's a very common in our community. And that, Dor Yesharim obviously doesn't check. Why? Because if you have the BRCA gene, it doesn't matter who you marry. And so there are a lot of things that are not really, that don't fall into what Dor Yesharim should say we should do, because they are genetic things that are connected to that specific person, irrespective of who they marry. So we have to make a serious distinction between those two. So Dor Yesharim is a wonderful organization. It solves a very specific problem. However, the disadvantage is a closed system. You don't get an answer, yes or no. You get a number. And a lot of people don't want to get a number. They want to know what they have, because knowing what you have has certain importance. On the other hand, we don't want to create Mishpachat HaNichsim. So that makes sense.
Which is brought to Allah. I believe the Shulchan Aruch and Sibid Beis, and Evid Ezra Beis, brings that to Allah.
Say it again.
Said it's Lahalacha, Mishpachas Nechsim is brought not only the Gemara, but Evid Ezra and Sibid Beis.
Sure, so you're not allowed to create a Mishpach, you're not allowed to marry Mishpachas Nechsim, and we don't want to create Mishpachas Nechsim. And so what I think the poorest position is that genetic testing pre-marriage is a good thing, and for many people, Dor Yesharim may solve their problem. And that possibly after marriage, a couple might want to add the certain things that are specific for them that have not been covered by Dor Yesharim, such as we said, the BRCA gene is one example, or Fragile X and other things that are examples of things that are not. However, if we have a couple that are, they know they have a genetic abnormality before because there's something in their family, so Dor Yesharim doesn't really answer their need. If we know that, if we have a couple who maybe come from different ethnic backgrounds, so he's Ashkenazi, she's Sephardi, they may have different things that don't really covered by Dor Yesharim. And so we'd have to look at each case specifically to see whether that was something that there was a need to have, whether Dor Yesharim answers their need or not. So I think Dor Yesharim answers for a very specific community. I don't think it answers for everybody. That's what I would say. Yes.
So would you, J-Screen, which does 200 plus tests, if somebody came to you, a regular boy and girl, garden variety boy and girl, Yaakov and Rachel, and they said, should we do Dor Yesharim or the very big screening? what would you say, what, how do you advise them?
Again, it depends what do they want to know? They're already a couple, they want to know, should
maybe,
we get married?
Maybe there are some other rare diseases that Darius Sharam doesn't test for, that through their marriage they will exponentially increase the odds of having them, right?
Right.
Should they do it or not?
And they're low risk. Let's get
they're
your
just a regular boy
makeup.
And a regular girl. They come from
low.
Come
so they're low risk. The chances of them finding something that's going to make an impact is low. It's not very high. The
right.
question then would be, would they get married anyway or not? So if they're
well,
saying, we're never going to get married until we test, the problem is that we can over-test. You know, Doris Sharon did a good thing. They have a cutoff point in which they said that something that's such and such a parent, it appears such and such a time, that's something that we're going to test. We're not going to test everything. And so there are companies, I don't want to get into any specific company, that will test lots and lots and more things. And
right.
some of those things possibly are not so significant. I know, for example, the J-Screen has a policy that they'll only test things that have that are life-threatening. You can go to other companies that will test things that are not life-threatening. They will say, you know, we can test lots of things that may have an impact on your life, but are not really life-threatening. And so those things, I think, are probably not necessarily to come before you get married. Again, because you're saying, I'm not going to get married if we both have this recessive gene, which is extremely rare. So if a young man comes to me and says, I want to know what I have, Doris Sharam doesn't answer your question. You can only answer that if you go to a regular company that's going to check, have what we call open testing, that you know the answer.
Sure.
But if it's a couple say, we're thinking about getting married, should we, and we just want to know the regular things, and we and then afterwards we'll check it out, and then we won't get married, we'll get married, but we want to know what we have, then I would say, Doris Sharam will answer your need immediately to get married.
We know
and
the difference. I'm asking you, Rabbi,
right.
what's your opinion? Would you send your kids? Would you send your kids to J-Screen or to Darius Sharam?
I'm covering it because this is the way we work in Pua. I think Pua works differently than lots of other places. Every case is case specific. So my question is, what are they asking? So if they're asking, we want to know these things, so we have it, then Darius Sharam answers your question. If my children would say, I want to do Darius Sharam, that's great. However, if they would say, I want to know what I have, and I'm not, for me, being a carrier is not Mishpachat HaNichfim, then I would say J-Screen or a similar organization would be a good answer for you, not option two. That's why I think that we have to be clear that Doris Sharam answers a need. It's not we have to get rid of Doris Sharam because it's, you know, it's passé. It's not true. Doris Sharam answers a very important need. And
so
J-Screen and other
you,
organizations.
Why wouldn't you go to J-Screen and just eliminate risk? It doesn't cost any more money.
So that's a good. If it costs exactly the same and you would say you're going to get the same information, yes. Why not? Because I think there are a lot of people that being a carrier, they view as being Mishpachat Nichfim. And I go back, as I said, that's why the history was important of the Rabbanim that came out against Doris Sharam, including Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and others who came out against it and said, We're going to taint these families. So if you're in a community that being a carrier is a taint, is a mum, is a tainted family, is a mishpachat hanichsin, then that is not something you want to get because you're going to find an information you don't want to know. And I wanted to say more than that. I think that today, and I had this discussion actually with somebody in J-Screen, that we are testing and finding out information in the area of genetics today. We know much more information than we know what to do with. I.e., we're finding out a lot of information. We don't really know what's the ramifications of this genetic abnormality. We don't know what it will lead to. We don't exactly know where it will go. And so we sometimes overtest. We have to understand that as well. Sometimes the overtesting is not always, not all knowledge is good knowledge. Not all knowledge is going to help you in your life. But if you're the sort of person that you can handle being a carrier, and that will limit who you can marry, but it will still not necessarily destroy your life, then open testing may have an advantage.
So let me tell you if this summary, I'm going to try to summarize what you said. J-Screen does a much wider set of tests for more remote diseases that are, but I mean, when parents have them, for example, like multiple sclerosis,
I'm sorry. What did we have? I apologize. My brain is cystic fibrosis that others don't test for, and you know, and when two carriers of cystic fibrosis, it exponentially increases the possibility, right?
Correct.
But it's somewhat remote, and they won't.
I think that situation does cover cystic fibrosis.
Or maybe that's a more recent.
At least some of the mutations. But I understand you. There are rarer things. You look on the panel of.
There are rarer things. And the attitude is, and I think we've heard some Rabbanim basically express it. They said, you know, at a certain point, you know, you become where people just don't want to get married. I mean, everybody, imagine if you could test somebody at the time of dating for ability to one day earn a living. Ability to, you know, how they would bring up their children, anger issues.
Maybe I wouldn't be married.
Depression.
I don't know about you, but
anybody would end up getting married. And part of life is like, you know, we weren't to work out issues and carry each other through, you know, tough times, be they emotionally tough times, physical tough times, or psychological tough times, or financial tough times, et cetera. That's what marriage is about.
But again,
life
and I think it's
so. If
I
we
think
wanted to scrub out, right. If we wanted to scrub out, nobody would get married. What they are basically saying, Dari Sharm, is look, things that are davar motzei that you have to be chayshish for, and it's staring at you. If you don't do it, you're bordering on a posheya. So that's where Dari Sharm does.
And Moshe has a tshuva that seems to suggest that as well. That the thing that you could find out, you didn't find out, is not tamim tiyam Hashem Elokecha, it's craziness. Having said that, there are solutions today. I have couples who got married knowing that they both were carriers of serious genetic abnormalities, that as you said, have a great chance of having children who will have that, who will be sick and who will be, and life will be threatened. There are solutions that we can do today. There
PGRD,
are, there is, there's
to,
PGD. There are things that can be done. And so a couple might say, but I want to know that because we're going to get married anyway. We love each other. We think that we can support each other. All of the things you just said, which are as important as being healthy. We're going to have a panasa and we're going to be learn Torah. We're going to be, our Shabbos table will be the best ever. But we have a genetic abnormality, but we're going to have children. We want to know that information because we're going to have children through PGD, and then our children hopefully will be healthier than they would otherwise. So such a person, Dori Sharm doesn't answer that question. And they would need an open testing. So again, it's very, very much case-based. And I think, again, both all of the organizations, there's a reason why there's Dori Sharm and there's a reason why there's J-School. The reason why there's Dori Sharm is that it answers a need, but not for everybody. And therefore, J-Screen answers a need, but not for everybody. There are people that will never do J-Screen. There are people that will never do Dori Sharm. So between them, I think that we cover. And I think what both of them, that's very important, that's why we're having this conversation today, is what both of them have done, have put genetic screening on the map. They've made it legitimate in our community, but it was not 20, 30 years ago. No one did genetic screening. And Dori Sharm came along and said, it is legitimate, it should be done. And J-Screen has benefited from that and saying, not only is it legitimate, but there are other ways of doing, which is also legitimate. And that debate is incredibly important and has saved our community in one generation. I'm saying there's no other community in the world that has that, that has been able to, in one generation across the community, basically eradicate well-known genetic diseases they have, and that we should be very proud of that.
And I want to say that we've had Rabbi Eckstein on the phone, and to me, he's like the he's almost like Nayach, one person who changed the entire world, a Chassidish fellow without an education. Our community owes such incredible Hakara Satayv, and
100%.
You see the impact, like, you know, when we say in Chazal, that kolam kaim nefesh echaz kilukim olam ole, how one person is like the entire. Here is one person who's had an impact on our entire world. One lone individual. He's Noach and the Teva is really what Rabbi Eckstein, the incredibly courageous and the person with vision, has had on our community.
And I hope the poor has done a similar thing in fertility. I hope that it's put it on the map and people are speaking about it. It's not embarrassment. We just had a conversation about, you know, egg donation and surrogacy. These are issues that appear in our community and need to be discussed as well. And it's not an embarrassment to have them. And I think it's also a trailblazer to be able to do that.
So what is the message of Pua? Like, you say that there's embarrassment, et cetera. Like, what area is there of embarrassment that if you say, wow, if there's this one thing that I could just, this message, what would it be?
I think that we have to realize if we go to Pua's original spec, and what we continue to do, and I hope we do well, is to deal with fertility, is exactly what you just said about, and I very much appreciate and resonate what you said about Rabbi Eckstein, my view of it, is that it could be a trailblazer in the area of fertility in three ways. A, to inform Rabbanim that this is available, it can be done al pi halacha, it can be done with hashgacha, there's no mistakes made in the lab, it is something that is legitimate and can be done. The second is to look at the doctors and to say to the doctors there are specific needs of the firm Jewish community and we can help them. There's no reason why a couple shouldn't undergo treatment because of halacha or because somehow they're it's not available to them. And the third, I think, is to help the couple, is that a couple who experience infertility believe that they are alone. No one else is with them. They're the only people in their entire family, their entire shul, their entire community who have fertility problems, and to let them know that that is not the case. If there's someone, that first of all, it's a very common occurrence, and there are many people who are experiencing it and they don't know about. And to give them somebody to empathize with them, to speak to them. I think all the couples, the doctor, they say, the doctor wasn't very nice to me. I say, you don't need the doctor's nice. You want someone to be nice? I'll be nice to you. They say, we have no one to speak to. Don't speak to the people who do you feel are not validating you, come to speak to me. And so our ability to help those couples, and they avail themselves of treatment, and they're successful, and there are thousands of children. We get about 150 calls. We get about 200 calls every day here in Eretz Yisrael, and we get more calls around the world. And we are involved in the births annually of about 1,500 Jewish children worldwide. And that's a phenomenal number of people who are being helped, who are looking for help, and who need help. And we're happy to be able to say this is available to you.
Now, Rabbi Weiss, what do you say to there are Paiskim or Rabbanim I've seen who say that, you know, doing things like, you know, egg donors, it's against the Torah, Tamim Tiyem Hashem Elokecha, it's a question of Klayim, it's a question of you being Mishana the Bria. We have the right to tinker with God's world. How do you respond to that?
That's it. So if a couple would come to me and say, we hold by a love who holds you can't do egg donation. You said before, you mentioned surrogacy, which is a rare. I'm saying that's not such a common occurrence, but we'll take surrogacy. I've had couples that I went to their love and I sat with them, or their rebbe, and I sat with them and they said, it's a sore. The answer to that couple is, it's a sore because your rebbe won't permit it, and that's okay. So that's perfect. Everybody has to go with their Rav, Selech HaRav tells us, the mission tells us. So, Selech HaRav, there are Rabbanim who permit it, and there are who are there. If your Rav is Oseh, that's your Psak. If your Rav is not there,
but how do you
that's
respond? That's on a practical level. How do you intellectually respond to Rav who says, we are not, don't play Hashem, don't play God, Tamim Tiyem Hashem Alekecha, don't be Mishana Maisa Bereshis, etc. How would you respond intellectually to him?
I mean, on a purely intellectual level, not on a halachic level. So
I'm
purely
saying
intellectually.
How would you respond in learning? Forgetting about learning, how would you respond?
I mean, I think that, you know, if we just look at the history, and I think it would be a very, very fascinating history book to look at how, when IVF first came out, when they first did a regular in vitro fertilization, almost all the Rabbonim came out against it and said exactly what he said. Mishana Brias is going to be under Lamusia. We're not going to know. It's going to be, you're going to have Zeri Sron, Zeri Nochri, and it's all going to be a big, big mess. The Maisa is today, almost all the Rabbonim up here, IVF, you said about Rabbi Yoshev, Rav Shlomo Zalman, the Vosner, all of the poskim were matir, and the Hasidish poskim were matir IVF. Why? A, because it became extremely common. B, because there was hashgacha to make sure it was okay. And C, there was an awareness. So why isn't that Mashana Bria? You came to the realization that that's really the hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is how the development of HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us, in the same way that we have treatment for all sorts of other ailments and all sorts of other conditions. Egg donation is in a very different category. It is third party. Third party is elective. No one has to do it. I don't know if you're making the mitzvah peruvu by having a child through egg donation. It's a very good shaila. Those are pashut. And so, but on some level, that couple is experiencing a something that's akin to a machala, akin to an illness, and this is the treatment that we have for them. And so, are there things that we become overly playing the hand of a Kodesh Baruch Hu? The answer is probably yes, and I would shy away very, very carefully from those things. But I think since they're Rabbonim, that say that they're
like
okay,
what? Give me an example. Like what would you shy away from?
Things in which we are changing genetic makeups, and we're, as you said before, eradicating unwanted genetic traits, which may actually not be at all life-threatening. We can do today PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, to get a child to size up the child's height. I want a child. I don't want a child that's small. I want a child
designer baby.
Talk about a dwarf. We want to, my one child is going to be my designer baby. That's already a very, very problematic area. Because then really you're deciding that, that this trait is not wanted in a Kodesh Baruch Hu's world. That's a big problem. That's a very big problem. However, if we have a procedure, medical procedure, that's almost, but the IVF is basically natural. You take an egg, you take a sperm, you put them together. So it's true that we do it through the doctors, but it's essentially copying the natural norm. Egg donation is a more bigger problem. I think there was a couple that came to me recently, and they had several, so they had already several children, and during, unfortunately, a very, very difficult birth, the wife had to remove her uterus in order to save her life. And they then wanted to use a gestational carrier to, in order to have children. And I talked them out of it because I thought that if you have, if it's something that's almost pikuach nefesh in the fact that if you have no children, to have any child, we have to moshe nefesh. But if a couple already have children, and this has happened sort of through an unfortunate but almost natural occurrence.
Rabbi Weitzel, let me interrupt. We would both agree that there's certainly no mitzvah be'erev al tanach yadecha. There's no chiv al be'erev al tanach yadecha to have to go through gestational
in this case,
carriers.
For example.
There's not going to be a rub in the world who would disagree with that statement.
And then we can go even more than that. A woman who just says, I'm now post, I have children. I have nine children. I'm postmenopausal. I want to do egg donation. The rabbi would say, that's not.
Yeah,
egg donation
yeah,
wasn't
so.
For your case. And so there are
rabbi,
clear things that they would say that's already. There's a natural process. But the,
rabbi,
real, the reality
you,
is, yes. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you another question. How would you respond to a woman, a girl, who went through J-screen, and she does have the BRCA gene, or, you know, fragile eggs, et cetera, some of these serious, serious issues. At what point should she, does she have a chiyuv to disclose it while dating? How do you respond to that? How do you deal with
that? That's the million-dollar question. And the question is basically, you know, the sugyam is that the question is it a mekach tot? At what point would somebody want to know that? And so fragile eggs, in which we know that there's a high chance of having children, it depends on how many repeats it is, we're not going to get into the technicalities, but fragile eggs in which there's a high chance you would have children who would be seriously sick is maybe different than BRCA, than BRCA, in which it's possibly a woman who may get cancer later on in her life. But then again, chas v'chalila, anybody could get cancer later on in their life. And so she's at a greater risk, but it's not, those are two different situations, scenarios. I think that if you tested and you know that you have a genetic abnormality that's dominant, for example, or you have a BRCA gene, then you would have to share it. Otherwise, I think today we would consider that mekach tot. If the man had known, he would have thought that was a mum. That's according to halacha, that's a mekach tot, if he'd have known it and he thought it was a mum.
Yeah, but respectfully, Rabbi Weitzman, if BRCA becomes a mekach tot,
right,
the fact that she knows it or doesn't wouldn't make a difference. In other words, if somebody buys something, a cow from somebody, and
right,
they find
right
out afterwards that it really it's missing, it's missing a very component that the seller didn't know, it's still a mekach tayis, right? Or if you buy it auto, mekach tayis is not contingent upon the seller knowing it's you, it's whether the buyer
but
was
it is
there.
Contingent
so
on
we,
something that's matsuri. It's contingent on it being Matsui. So if we say,
but
I had a question like this recently from somebody.
Let me just finish my point. My point is, if we're going to say that a brachygyte is something that a guy would say, look, if I had known, I wouldn't have. At that level, any person with a brachygyte, the husband could turn around and say, it's Bekartayas. I'm not sure that I would agree with that. And
I'll give you two answers. It's not like an islandness,
et cetera. What?
No, I agree. I'll give you two answers to that. One answer is, I had a case recently, a man came to me, has a daughter who has BRCA, and he wants to know, should he test his other daughters and they're not married? That's a very complex issue. That's why I would say that we should really not test BRCA and issue at a high risk until he get married, because otherwise we're going to create a situation. The other thing I would say, which is very important, and that I think goes back to our question about Dori Sharim, and goes back to what we said about Pur before, is that it's also a process of education. Is that if I have to educate people, what is the ramifications of having BRCA gene? You might say I have it, but then what does that mean? Because we're talking about, let's say we have a young woman who's now 20 years old, she's going out to get married, or she's 18, she's going to get married. And we're talking about what will happen in 20 years' time. What neither me, nor you, nor she, nor the chosen, nor anybody else knows is how we're going to treat cancer in 20 or 30 years' time. We don't know. And so it's very possible that it won't be as serious as it is today. It may be, but again, we could all get cancer. We all have the propensity, everybody has propensity to diseases. And so it's a process of education. If someone would come to me and say, I'm going out with a girl, this is what she's got, BRCA, what should I do? Then you'd have to take into account their age, what's their family history, and see how you would manage it. I would recommend them to get married younger. I would recommend them to have children younger, and then maybe they would have surgery. That's what we're suggesting today. But in 20 years, I mean, maybe suggesting something very, very
different. So, Rabbi Breitz,
so we're not a question of education about mum. The idea of what's a mum and what's not a mum has definitely changed and changes the whole time. It's a dynamic.
So, Rabbi Breitz, all the rabbanim we've spoken to agree that BRCA should not be tested for. It's asking for questions we don't have answers to. And there was a lot of uncertainty whether to disclose.
Hello?
I'm sorry. Yeah. The Rabbanim we've spoken to have almost universally said, do not test for BRCA, single girl. And I couldn't get an answer out of, if it's discovered, whether to disclose. What is Pua's position?
I think if you know about it, I think it's hard to not say. But what I would do, and like I said to a young man this week who was in my office who had a genetic abnormality, I said, you can go and get married. And before you get married, you're going to have to tell your kala what you have, because it's a serious thing. But you'll bring her to my office, and I'll explain to her the ramifications. You'll tell her the reality that you have it. I'll explain to her what that means. And she will decide whether that she wants to go into that. And so that's what I would do. I would say to the couple, to the woman, the young woman who's at a high risk, you might have to say, but what are the ramifications of that? I'm willing to discuss and explain. And there's actually a very nice story of Rosh Hashanah Mazama with a girl who had, who was going with a boy who had epilepsy. And he checked out the boy and he said, Mazel Tov, you check him out. I'm willing to explain to you what that means and to look at this case and to say, how can you handle that? How can you manage that? BRCA is not a death sentence. It's not a death sentence. Maybe it's cancer death sentence, but it's not a death sentence. It's not like having, you have something that was clearly degenerative, but it's not the case with BRCA. So we need to educate.
Right.
Speaking about today is education. But I think if you have it, I think it's hard to say, I didn't know. Oh, it's something discovered I had BRCA after we got married. So that's as we agree that it would be better not to test prior to getting married.
Rabbi Weitzman, and how much do you charge for your calls and your services at Pua?
The services at Pua, so all of the counseling is all free of charge. And we think that that's a policy, because I don't want the couple to think, is it worth me? Am I going to get, I've already got a large expense on doing treatment. I don't want to come. It's free of charge, whatever you cost.
So all your hundreds of thousands of calls you do for free?
Free of charge. The supervision has a very subsidized rate, and if people can't pay, we're able to cover it. And in fact, in the tri-state area, New York, it's actually now free. And their educational programs cost, as per cost, it depends what the program is. But we try to have, we have a very, very small budget. We try to take the cost away from the couples and to be able to help as many of them as possible.
I could say only Mika Amra Yisrael. We have so much tzaras, but on the other hand, look what we do for each other. Yeah, Rabbi Weitzman, Rabbi Shalom should give you koyach that you should continue giving eitzes at 1,500 children a year. What can I say? One day you'll look up and you'll say, "Es'ela di asisi, mi baral li eilev, es'ela di asisi." Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and Michal, how with your program, and I appreciate it very, very much. Call to
thank you. Bye-bye.